Alors, on continue en français.
Then I will admit that I found it really hard to give a talk or a lecture in French because most of the words like entanglement and qubits and things like this don't come to my mind that easily. So it might be easier for you guys if I keep on speaking English. Qubit?
Okay.
So once I gave a talk in Quebec City and I put a set of words in English that they didn't know what to translate.
Oh.
And then I asked the students and prof, give me the translation of this, and they couldn't for half of them. So I said, then I don't feel too bad. Okay, so what did we see yesterday? We look at nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. We define the qubits. They are the magnetic moments of the atoms in molecules. And we put this in a very strong magnetic field. They point up is the zero, they point down is the one. They point in some other direction. It's a superposition of zero and ones. We talk about how we act on these qubits. There's a small coil that goes through the sample. And when we send radio frequency field at the frequency which correspond to each of the qubit, it corresponds to a magnetic field that will affect that qubit. So in that rotating frame, it looks like a constant field. So if your spin started with a direction up, and you put a field at this frequency in the rotating frame, which looks like in the x, there's a torque in the third direction, makes your spin going true. Depending on the power and the time, in fact, the product of the two, then you're going to do different angles of rotation. Okay? And so to calibrate how much is a pi over 2, you have to go and look at measurements that you do. And as we mentioned, the observable in the system is the operator sigma x and sigma y. So when you're in the z direction, you don't observe anything because the trace of rho times x, when rho is only as a z component, is zero. But when it's as you increase the amount of x by rotating around the y-axis, then you see the Fourier transform of the current gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You reach the maximum when you do pi over 2, and then it starts to decrease when the spin goes to minus 1. Turns out that when we calibrate, usually we calibrate an 180 degree or 290s instead of a pi over 2, because arriving to the maximum, as you change the angle a little bit, it gets flat because it's like the square part. But when you calibrate it at minus 1, like kind of the state 1, then you go to a 0, a sine of theta, and so it's linear. So we do 290s, we calibrate, and then we know what we can do. Okay, so we add qubits. One qubit gate. Now I mentioned calibrating. When you do experiments, you never get the calibration perfect. Like, you try as best as you can to get a 90 degree, but many small imperfections stops you. There's noise in the system, so you don't really see when you get zero. Sometimes your radio frequency generator is not exactly reproducible. In fact, right now we're working with electron spin resonance. And then we see that when we make many gates, the power changes a little bit. And the phase of the electromagnetic field changes as we make more gates because the amplifier heats up and this heat up do things. So you have to learn all that these pieces doing something. Now, I'm going to give you a trick. If you want to do a 90 degree pulse, then you have an error of epsilon. So how can you improve this? So let's say we have z, we have x, y. We start with polarization in that direction. And then we want to do, let's say, a 180 degree. But instead of having e to the minus I pi over 2 y, we have an epsilon which comes in there because of miscalibration and error. And then in NMR, it turns out that we have much better control on the phase of the field than on the power itself. And you can use that to kind of improve these pulses. And here's a neat way how you can do this. So if there's an error like this, in fact, I'm going to put a minus here, and I assume that epsilon is positive, but you'll be able to switch as you see this. Instead of doing a single pulse like this of pi over 2, you can do of pi in this angle, and there's a 2 because it's a spin half, you do a pi over 2 pulse around y. So your magnetic moment is going to go here, okay, and there'll be a gap here of epsilon. And now you're going to do a rotation around x by 180 degrees. So this is going to bring it down there, okay? And you'll have an epsilon error in that direction, okay? And then you I'll say there's 2 epsilon because it's you do twice the pulse in the x direction, and then you do the other pulse that comes here. And you see that this little trick here compensate this epsilon error that you're doing. You can see that if the epsilon, I told you epsilon was positive here, which means it's kind of a bit shorter. But if it'll be longer, the same thing would happen. It would happen here, and you would do your rotation around the x, which will bring it there, and then you would make this happen. So by instead of doing one pulse and having an error epsilon on what you're doing, you can do 3 pulses and get an error which is epsilon squared. So by combining different things, you can make things a little bit more robust. And these kind of tricks we use all the time, kind of way of thinking. Now, the price that you pay on this, and the assumption here, is that when you say you do a rotation around y, it is really a rotation around y and x, really a rotation y. If you have an error in there, then this is not going to work as well. But in NMR, this is really, really good. Now, I assume that we started with this direction here. If you do the same thing, starting with a direction, like say here or here, this is not going to work. You'll see you want to improve. But you can generalize this pulse, providing only 3, a composite pulse with 3 components. You can generalize it with 5 components, and then it's independent of where you start with, and go from epsilon to epsilon squared. Yep. Okay, so a little comment about robust pulse, 1-qubit gate. We mentioned also about 2-qubit gates, and they came from what we called the J coupling. And the J coupling is the interaction which is mediated by an electron. And as long as the difference between the Larmor frequency is much bigger than the value of this J, the couplings looks like Z1, Z2. Okay? And you can think about this, and so a bit classically, about what does that, the effect of that coupling is that if the first qubit is in the state 0, it's an eigenstate of 0, it'll do a Z2 rotation of the second qubit. But if the first qubit is in the state 1, it's an eigenstate with eigenvalue minus 1, it'll do a minus Z rotation. So depending on the first qubit being up or down, the second qubit is going to either rotate this way or rotate this way around this axis. Okay? So you can think about kind of what's happening to your. You can think a little bit now, if you have a superposition of zeros and ones, then the second bit also goes in the superposition depending on what is the first qubit. So in that sense, this is the entangling gates. And you can transform this into control knot if you like to do control knots. Okay. One thing that I swept under the carpet in there in yesterday, I just mentioned it and I said we'll get back to this, is the initial state. And so I want to come back. So if you leave your sample, you go for a cup of coffee, you come back, and it can be a short cup of coffee, about 30 seconds. You have to go back to work sometimes, so not too long cup of coffee. then the state is 1 e to the minus beta h. And you remember beta times omega, okay, is very small. H will be sum of zi omega I frequency for each of them plus sum over I not equal to j, jij, zi, zj. That's the Hamiltonian. The value of this is hundreds of megahertz. The value of this is hundreds of hertz. So this is much very small. This is very much, much, much smaller. So when you look at the initial state, you can forget about this term here. You cannot forget about it when you try to do dynamics. But as an initial state, this is extremely small. It's a part of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5. It would change things a little bit. But yeah. So in this case, so the initial state is of the form, let's say for 1 qubit, will be plus epsilon times z. And this epsilon, the trace, is called the polarization, 10 minus 5. Now, this is not the state 0. In fact, I'm going to add one qubit just to show you. If we have another qubit, let's say they have the same roughly frequency, you would have this. Something which would look like of this form here. So this is not a pure state. Okay? And when we do algorithm, quite often we think about starting for pure state. But you don't have to start with pure state. Right now I'm going to show you one algorithm you can do, which at some point might be a useful thing to do. And it will come back later on in the lecture. So it is easy to get rid of some of these operators. So you can do two experiments and add them together. And you can have a part like this, that this one of the two which change. Just make one experiment where you just look at this. The second experiment, you're going to do the same thing, except that before observing, you're going to rotate the second qubit around the x-axis by pi over 2. Or, sorry, by pi in the Bloch sphere. If you rotate z around x by an angle pi, you get to minus z. So they're going to change, make a minus sign here. And if you go and add both experiments' result on the spectrum, you will get rid of this term here, and you'll get this only. Okay? So if you look at the spectrum, initially we'll have something like this. The second experiment, you get something like this. You add the two, and what you'll observe after that is correspond only to the first peak. So it is easy to have this. Now, if you have only one qubit in z, it's essentially like having a pure state in that case. Because if you think about the state 0, how can you write this in terms of these operators? Okay, write 0 in terms of Pauli operators.
Identity plus set.
Is what?
Identity plus set.
That's it. Okay, you remember that z is 1 minus 1. This is 1, 1. The 1 and minus disappear, so you have this. It's not too hard to know what 1 would be. It would be more than minus z. So here's one algorithm that people worked out where you have only one qubit with some amount of polarization. So we're going to start at the 1 plus epsilon z. And then tensor 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 for all the other qubits. So all the other qubit is in the unit density matrix. And we're going to make an Adamard transform. Okay? Or the poor man's, poor person's Adamard transform, which is a rotation around y by pi over 2, which is up to a phase like Adamard, is going to change z to an x. Then we're going to do the control gate. If your B measure is 0 or 1, then do the NMR again and observe. As you remember, in NMR, we observe X. So we don't do the other NMR. And here we measure the trace of rho and X on the first qubit. Okay. So what does that circuit do? You remember that the initial state. So if I have a Z part here, I'm going to borrow a little piece of epsilon of that one. So I'm going to write it as 1 plus Z. So I can think about it as the state 0 that we start with. OK, tensor, the unit matrix for the n other qubit. We did an NMR transform of this. So what do I get? Right? NMR on this part, NMR on this part. This transform is 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1. I'm just collecting all this. And I should write the big unitary transform. And now I'm going to do a control U. So you remember the control, again, because here I'm working not with the states, with the density matrix. And this is what I've done here at MR on both sides. Now I have to have a control U on both sides. So when I have 0, 0, what happens? Nothing. Okay. When I have 0, 1, this piece doesn't give me anything. But here, the 1 is going to do my control. So I'm going to, and the control is a U dagger going this way. So I'm going to write this as U dagger. Now this, not too hard to find out what it is. And in 1, 1, I have U dagger this way, U dagger this way, and U is unitary. U dagger times U is? Identity, so I get this. And now I'm going to go measure X. Okay? You remember X is the off diagonal terms. X looks like 0, 1, 1, 0. So this element is a 0, 1, and this one is the 1, 0. So there's really nothing that comes here, nothing that comes here, and there's a half or something that comes out of here and here. And what you get is that trace of this times X is equal to U dagger plus U. OK? Or, and there's a factor that comes out of here of 1 to 2 to the n, OK? Which is a real part of this unitary operation. Okay? It turns out that for generic U, it's incredible. We do not know how to do a quantum circuit which would represent it. But if I represent the families of U that can be built with 1 and 2 qubit gates that I have, then quantum mechanically, I can go and find what is this. And sorry, I missed one part. I have the trace here. So it's really the trace of the real part of U. It's not U plus U dagger. I need to have a number that comes out of there. So it's the trace of this. Okay? So we can make quantum circuits that where classically is incredibly hard to find what is trace. But quantum mechanically, we can go and find this. And it turns out that we can do this where U represents some function related to Jones polynomial, or some physics system where U trace if the system is chaotic or not. So we can do an algorithm here with a mixed state where we get something which is hard to find classically. And the reason why I talked about this is that it turns out that most of your qubits are totally mixed. There's only a small amount of purity in here, and you can still do this. So you might say, where is this coming from? This looks like a very noisy state. And it comes from what we're measuring is really the phases that comes in here. And although we have something which is very mixed here, there, we assume there's no decoherence when this happened. We don't randomize these phases, and this phase that comes from this U are getting what is called kickback on the first U bit, and we can measure that. So that's the first algorithm that we can do with NMR. Okay, but you might not be totally happy to say this is the whole family F. In fact, this is a model of quantum computation called DQC1, deterministic quantum computing with one bit of information, assuming that all the others are not. We don't think we can measure, do any kind of, any imaginary, imaginable quantum computation with that model, but we can do something which we don't know how to do classically. Okay. So another approach is to call what is called a pseudo-pure state. You remember when I showed you the spectrum? For one qubit, you had one line when it is isolated. It's coupled to a second qubit. We had two lines, one corresponding to the other qubit being in a state 1 or in the state 0. If you have two other qubits, then this corresponds to a line which is 1, 1 for the other two qubits. So one qubit isolated, interacting with one qubit, interacting with two qubits. So these lines correspond as a flip of the qubit you're looking at, but having the other qubit being in that pure state. So in the same trick that we've done here by getting rid of this, you can do an experiment where you start with these four lines, then you rotate that line by 180 degrees, and you subtract these two results, and what you will see in a spectrum a single line. And that single line corresponds to an operator, x for the first qubit, but the state, in fact, if I put that one, it'll be the state 1, 1, 1, 1 for the other qubit. Okay? And so this is a way of transforming rho, which is 1 plus epsilon z tensor 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, to something which looks like 1 plus epsilon psi. Okay. And if you think about doing a unitary transformation, a quantum computation, it's applying U tensor rho U dagger. You apply this to this part of the wave function, nothing happens. It remains the same through the quantum computation, but this is going to change. Then you can observe this. So that's one way of doing, again, quantum computation with NMR. Okay. Even if you don't have pure state, you do something which is called a pseudo. It's pseudo because it's just an epsilon from that. Okay. This works, again, because the time on which we apply these unitary transformations, there is no decoherence. And you remember I told you that the J was about 100 hertz. The one qubit gates are about milliseconds, 1 kilohertz. The decoherence time is 1 second. So during that time, you can do these unitary, and you can do something. So with this, in principle, you could do any kind of quantum computation, anything that you have. But in anything in life, there's a problem somewhere. It turns out that when you look at this peak, you get only 1 over 2 to the n of the signal. It becomes exponentially hard to do this. So really, you're decreasing your polarization by 2 to the n. So if you have just a few qubits, and this is what we do at a lab, up to a dozen of quantum bits, we go and do this. But if you want to have 100 qubits, 2 to the 100 is very large, and this would not work. Okay? So in the next few minutes, I'm going to tell you one way which will work. And we've done a little bit of experiments to make it happen, but it is research area to do this. And it's called algorithmic cooling. So here's the idea. We have a set of qubits. And is it possible to do a manipulation on these sets of the qubits so that we kind of concentrate the purity or the purity on a few of them at the expense of heating the other ones? Okay? Or concentrate the entropy on a bunch of them that we'll get rid of and not use for our quantum computation and doing this. And the question is, how much resources do we need to do this? Okay? And turns out the answer is yes. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that we want to purify only one of them. Okay? And to give you the example of how it works, I'm going to start with only three of them, show you how it works, and then I'll say, instead of having three, if you have n, here's what we do. And then I'm going to give a little twist to it. So if we have three qubits, and we say, what is the probability of getting 0, 0, 0? Okay? And in terms of that polarization, epsilon. Okay? So it will, and we assume that they got thermalized with their surrounding, so it'll be 1 plus epsilon for each of the qubit, power 3. And right now, so you have a 1/8 in front of all of this. I'm going to forget the 1/8 because that makes too many things to carry around. So it goes like 1 plus epsilon. Now suppose that I have one of the spins pointing up. What is the probability of getting that configuration? Well, this 2 squared minus epsilon for the one that pointed up. So this one is less probable because it's more energy. So what's the probability for this? Hey, you're supposed to shout something to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. What's this one? 0, 1, 1. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to write this because they are the inverse of this. I think by that time, although you're quiet, I think you got the idea. Now I want you to focus on this. We assume again that epsilon is greater than 0, so that the state 0 is the one which is more probable, which is the ground state. Okay? If you want to cool a qubit, you want the probability of being 0 to be higher than the probability of 1. Because the ground state, the exact ground state, should have probability 1 to be in 0. So we're trying to increase the probability of being in 0. If you look at this distribution, because here you have two 1s, the probability of the first qubit, which is the one we want to cool, okay? And we're going to use these two as kind of where we're going to throw some heat. We would like to have this being as large as possible. But because the more you have this of zeros, the lower the entropy is going to be. Okay? Ideally, you would like to have only zeros. But we cannot do projective measurement. If you do projective measurement, you'll be good. Here, we cannot do this. So you want to increase this. You look at this probability of this configuration, 1, 0, 0. This is greater than that. So you would like to do something to these two states to be able to switch the probabilities. And how do we do this? We just switch these states. So what does the unitary operation look like? It looks like this. Okay? Indeed, if you apply this on this density matrix row, which is made of these three qubits, you'll split these two things. And then you can go and calculate the trace over qubit 2 and qubit 3, okay, of the density matrix of the three qubits, okay, rho 1 is equal to this. And you say, what is the, now the probability of being in the state 0 and the probability of state 1? So we go and measure the polarization, the trace of rho 1 of Z1, okay, is the polarization. So initially, it was equal to epsilon, which was what we had here. And if you go and do it here, it'll be 3/2 of epsilon. So you boosted the polarization a little bit. Okay? So you can go and look at the, what is the polarization of qubit 2. Now you're going to trace over qubit 1 and qubit 3. You're going to make the trace of rho 2, z2. And then you'll get that it's 1/2 of epsilon. So you've warmed it up. So we have our three spins. We've made our gate. And what we end up is this thing is a little bit hotter, these two. It's good to have color. I should have red, but so this one got cooler. So I've done this with three. And then you can go and ask, now can it, instead of boosting up by 3/2 the polarization, and to get 3/2, I assume the polarization is small. Because if you would have an epsilon which is very near 1, I would get polarization greater than 1, which you cannot get. So I assume that epsilon was small. But as you go, you get a formula which is a little bit more complicated, but you can see that you boost it. To get polarization 1, okay, you need to get polarization about 1, you will need 1 over epsilon squared extra qubit. Okay? And this is a constraint that comes because we do things with unitary transformation. Now, I told you that epsilon was 10 to the minus 5 in NMR, so we need 10 to the 10. Oh, it's a long number. We don't have that many qubits. But we can do one thing which is very neat, is that we can increase the number of qubit here, but we could also have a bath, which has a polarization epsilon. This is what we started with. And then we can improve that algorithm that when these one become hot, we can swap them with the bath and start again. And then you can see how you go. And if you do this, okay, if you do this, you get a formula that epsilon asymptotic, I'm going to write it as this, is equal to 1 plus epsilon of the bath that you started with, power 2 to the n minus 2, where I'm going to be sure I n minus 3, if we count all of those in there. OK. 1 minus epsilon 2 to the n minus 3 divided by 1 plus epsilon 2 to the n minus 3 plus 1 minus epsilon 2 minus 3. And if you plot this, epsilon asymptotic as a function of the number of qubits, you'll see that there's a phase transition. When epsilon is smaller than 1 over 2 to the n, the asymptotic will give you 2 to the n epsilon. And because it's smaller than 1, you'll boost the polarization, but you won't get the to polarization 1. Okay? If epsilon is greater than 1 over 2 to the n, then you can get to polarization, which is is equal to 1 minus e to the minus 2 to the n minus 3. So you double exponentially, you get the polarization, which is equal to 1. And then you can go and do this. Okay? So by having a contact with the bath, you can do much better. So the present experiments that we do in an MR are to go and look at molecules that we add, okay, and look at different ones where suddenly we can take advantage of an electron instead of a nucleus. So there's a molecule called malonic acid, and there's two hydrogen that sticks out, and there's other things. Okay? We irradiate that molecule, do a crystal instead of liquid state, so that then electrons come in here. And do you remember what is the magnetic moment of the electron compared to the neutron, compared to the proton? So the electron is about 600 times. So mu in the electron is about 600 times, about 1,000 compared to the proton. Okay? So you remember where the polarization, which was 10 minus 5? By using the electron, we get 10 minus 2. And then instead of doing the experiments at 300 Kelvin, we're going to go to 3 Kelvin. So we're going to get to order 1 polarization. We won't get to 1. But if we use this idea, then we'll get pure state in that system. And this is the idea. Okay? Okay. I was going to show you how to do an EPR pair in an MR, but I'm looking at the time is running out. So I'm going to jump and stop here for an MR, ask you if you have questions about how does NMR work, and then give you a very, very, very brief description of other technologies like superconducting qubits or ion trap. And then I have a few slides which compares them and give you a bit of experimental input. Okay? So, no question?
In this case, does the bath have to be colder than all of the qubits?
So, you start with the polarization of all the qubits equal to the polarization of the bath. Then you start to do these operations. Okay? So maybe I should...
So then the hotter ones become hotter.
So become you cool, let's say you cool this one. These ones become hot. You cool them back to the temperature of the bath. But the temperature of the bath is higher than the temperature of that one. And then you do the same gate.
So you can't get away with just using the bath. Because the bath is the same temperature.
That's it. Like, so you start with the bath. And what you want is to do something which is better than that.
Okay.
So, in fact, this is an interesting algorithm. It's really a way of cooling. Usually we think about cooling things as, you know, you put something in your refrigerator, and then there's some heat that comes out of your ice cube. It hits the side of your refrigerator, and thermal fluctuation from the outside, because you're pumping something cold, then it sends back cold molecules that comes back, hit your water, and then that's how thermal fluctuation, randomly, you'll get the hot things being cooler and the cooler things being hotter. Here you cool in a deterministic way. You look at the state of your system and you say, by manipulating this, I'm going to cool that part here. And there's something called Maxwell's demon that you might have heard about. You have a big box, the atoms are moving there, and Maxwell's demon is there catching that one and say, oh, this is a slow one, I'll put it on the left. And if you catch a hot one, you put it on the right. My right, not yours. Okay? So in some sense, this is very similar to that. That by knowing what is the state of your system, you kind of pull the cold to the hot, kind of take the state so that you can concentrate the coolness here.
So how do you do it in practice?
Okay. So if you look at this gate, you want to call this one. So qubit one you want to call, qubit two, qubit three. It's a gate which looks like this. So this is a control not, control not, control not, and then control not. So we know how to do control not as a version of the ZZ interaction. And the Toffoli gate, I think it's either a homework or exercise. So you know how to do it in terms of square root of the control not. And you know how to do the control not again from the ZZ. So you can go and do this, an experiment. And so this one will become cooler. And then you have other qubits, okay, that you call the bath. Okay? And then you just make a swap. You know how to make a swap in terms of control knots? One person knows. It's three control knots, right? Something like this. That swaps this bit with this one. You can do this one with this one. And then you redo that thing and you reiterate again. Yeah? Now, when you do the physics of this, there's an interesting question of, suddenly you have the bath. While you do this, how can you ensure that the bath doesn't interact with your system? Or how do you really control this interaction with the bath? If anybody's interested, I'll stay for lunch today, and I can explain that to you. As I can see, I'm running out of time. Okay? So you need to know a little bit about other implementation. And if you take this little chip here, it's a chip on which there is two superconducting qubits. And if you move it a little bit, it's a little bit old, it gets oxidized, but you see little lines, and outside of these lines are these qubits. And so the idea of superconducting qubit is that you have a ring of superconducting material, typically aluminum. The ring has a capacitance C, inductance, L. And if you remember your electromagnetism, it means that there's a frequency which is 1 over LC. Okay? And this inductance behaves like an harmonic oscillator. Okay? And if you put current in there, then you'll have a flux, which can point up or can point down. So if you have an harmonic oscillator, then you have a series of level. If you take two of those, you can form a qubit. Now there's a little problem with harmonic oscillator. The difference between this and this is the same as the difference between this and this. So if you have the state one and you radiate radiation there, then you have a chance of going up to the third level. And you don't always, maybe you want to use a trick like in KLM, but maybe you don't. If you don't, you're stuck. So what people do is that they break this thing here and they put something which is called a Josephson junction. Josephson junction. And what this Josephson junction does is that it makes the harmonic oscillator anharmonic. So it changed that level. Let's say it goes down there. So when you're here and you radiate it with this, this level disappears. It has no place to go. And you really have a two-level system you want to compute. Now, a great advantage of this, and as you can see on the little circuit, is that you can use microfabrication facilities to build these things. Now, the world record around is about 10 qubits of this next to each other. That was done last fall. Okay. Ion traps. Okay. The basic idea is that, again, you take radio frequency fields and you take ions and you trap them with the radio frequency field. The field looks like an harmonic oscillator. In fact, in reality, there's all this little kind of giggle in there, but if it's small enough, you don't see them. Let's say you put two ions in here, in this trap. The qubit in here is the electronic level of these ions. So if you're in a ground state of the electron, You're in the state zero. You're in an excited state. Okay. You are on the state one. Okay. So you can do one qubit gate by irradiating this with light at that right frequency. And depending on the polarization, the time of the light, you can show that you can do all your x, y, z rotations. Okay. Now, how do they talk to each other? Well, they are in a potential. And so this potential here also has level. And so you can look at this as the excited state of the electron, but the ground state of this harmonic oscillator, which is a tensor product. And there's an excited state, which corresponds to these two ions moving like this in the mode. If you go to another excited state of this, it will correspond to the ion doing this. But we're going to limit ourselves only to the center of mass mode being coherent like this. So the way to talk, to have one ion talking to each other, instead of making a laser which goes there to do your single qubit, you can make a laser pulse which goes to the excited state of the electron and the excited state of the harmonic oscillator. So you excite this one, the electron up there, but at the same time, the two are moving. And then you can do the inverse here. You can send a laser pulse, which takes the information for the second qubit, okay, and then bring it down there. And with this, by doing the right pulse sequences, then you can transfer information from here to there. Okay? When you want to observe these things, you have a third level here. And then you irradiate light in here. If the state is in here, nothing happens, you don't see anything. But if the state is in here, then you see photon that comes again and again and again, and you have a detector which looks like this. So the efficiency of this detection is quite high. So you can go to very, very good value. Okay? I'm going to go and pass another sample, which is, you look at this, and you'll say, what is this boring little piece of gray material? Turns out it's a diamond. Okay? And there is one implementation of quantum computing, okay, where you use diamond, which is made of carbon, and then you look at the defect in the carbon. And there's different types of defects that you can see in diamond. So these diamonds are made here in Waterloo in what is called a CVD machine, kind of chemical vapor deposition. And we try to make them with very, very little number of defects. When you go to the jewelry store and you look at different diamonds, they have different colors. And different colors correspond to different types of defects that you have in the diamond. We're interested in diamond with nitrogen vacancy defects. So two atoms of carbon gets kicked out of the lattice. One nitrogen is replaced by one of the carbon, and there's an empty part. And then you have an electron structure that's formed around there. And this looks like an artificial atom. It's a nice artificial atom because the frequency that you need to excite this first levels of these electrons is in the green and the red light. So it's easy to talk. So we have a piece of diamond, and then they have some defects in them. And the defects are far apart to start with, so that they don't talk to each other. So it's a little bit about some NMR version in the solid state. You have some defects, but here you can talk to them straight to them instead of the NMR where you had a long wavelength. So you can excite this one. And if I remember well, you send green light, and what comes out, it's a level which is kind of halfway through. You send green light to this artificial atom, and some red light comes out. And so the light that you send is different than the light you observe, so you don't have this contamination of when you try to see what's happening with the system. So this is what happened with the electronic system. But in the middle, you can make diamonds with some carbon-13. And you can have the electron talks to the nuclear spins. So you can make small quantum processors. The idea to build a quantum computer with this is, might be a stretch, although I might some of my colleagues might give me a hard time if I say this, but they could become very good sensors because atoms are very sensitive to their surrounding. But they are hard to bring at the right place and pull out. But if they are embedded in the structure like a diamond, then it's easy to manipulate. You can use it, you can bring it somewhere. And if you have a couple of carbon 13 atoms, then you can run a small quantum algorithm which will be able to detect something and reject some other types of effects from the surrounding. So you could do a little bit of error correction, which will get rid of some type of noise, but not other type of noise. So like this, you isolated the different piece of the environment, so they detect and become what we call quantum sensors. Okay, now I'm gonna, can we have the projector, please? This is magic. Unfortunately, in fact, now the first traps that people were doing, they had four metal rods, two at the top, a bit like this, and they would put radio frequency fields on each of these electrodes, and the ions would line up in the middle, and it's, I think, the easiest trap that they have. But now they do microfabricated trap, which looks a little bit like one of these superconducting junction circuits, but with a hole in the middle, and the ions come in there. And I should get a copy of the one of those. It's a nice thing to me. And when you're done, don't forget to give it back to me. Okay, we have about 5 minutes. So I'm going to go a little bit quick. I'm going to send these slides to Aggie, and if you want to learn more, then I have a few slides just to show you some of the experiments. Like, if I would explain all the experiments that have been done in the last 10 years, then the course will last probably half a year of just explaining these sort of things. So I picked up a few things that are related to some of the kind of lectures that I did. You remember the non-scalable optics experiment. So here's an experiment then quite a long time ago, 1998, implementing this circuit. So looking at this circuit, what is it implementing?
Teleportation.
That's it, quantum teleportation. So here's the NMR in the control knot to entangle these two qubits. Your state of Alice has this qubit. Bob entangled this and then send that qubit to Alice. Alice change her basis because you measure only on 0 and 1. So if you want to measure the belt basis, you have to change the basis by doing unitary transformation. This is what she does. And these are the transformation that she has to do on the last bit of Bob to get the state psi. Now, we did this with a single photon. Okay, you remember the first proposal? But like an experimentalist, they always push, and I was going to say cheat, but again, I'm recorded, so I should be watch out of our guys. They always kind of look at whatever resources they have, and they are smart. They use the resources that they have. And here, instead of a photon degrees of freedom, they use the polarization of the photon. And so photon comes through here or here, depending if it's 0 or 1 or superposition of the two. It goes to a beam splitter, which corresponds to this NMR here, another set of beam splitters corresponding to the other NMR, and then he does some control knots. Because this is the polarization, it's easy to do a control knot. You just have a polarizer which flips the bit. Depending on the photon being in one of these four paths, because the state is the path. The path is the state. To do a control knot here, you would have to do it when the bottom qubit is in the state 0, so state 1. To do this one, the top qubit has to be in the state 1. But you realize that when you get to 1, 1, then you flip it and you flip it again, so you don't do anything. So you need only two of these polarizer, which correspond to the state 1, 0, when you have 1 here, and then the 0, 1 when you have the 1 in there. Okay? So I've given a little bit of the answer if you want to follow it, but you can look at the complexity of making that small circuit of all these beam splitters going in again, right? Getting put together. So when we had looked, that turned into some experiments. I mentioned attempt number two to do this, we need a nonlinear interaction. And here's some experiments, again, quite some time ago, of sending two photons in a cavity with an atom. And if you have one atom that comes in, you get a phase phi A. The other photon comes in, you would have a phase phi B. But when you have the two photons comes in, there's an interaction between the photons and the cavity, delays the photon coming back out, and you get a phase which is not only phi A plus phi B, which was B linear, you get a delta. And they went to measure what is the value of the delta, and it got 16 degrees. If you want to have a cosine gate, you would have to have 180 degrees. So you would have to do this 10 times. And this, I can tell you, to get the 16, they work as hard as they could to show. So we do have nonlinearity, but they are typically small. Now I'm looking at my next slide, which is missing. There's a paper I've seen in the last year of people doing something similar, but with many atoms instead of one. And then they got a boost of this nonlinearity. Still very hard to put this in a quantum computer, but it's a place that if somebody at some point find the right mechanism, this would be a nice way of building a quantum computer. We talk about linear optics quantum computing. So this is the group of Jeremy O'Brien and Brithell. And this, by now, you should recognize what is this gate. Okay, it's the nonlinear gates when alpha zero plus b, alpha plus beta a1 dagger plus gamma a1 dagger squared as a nonlinear terms when you go through a bunch of beam splitters and measure one and zero there. Well, I gave you that implementation. Turns out that there are simpler ones. And here's one that they've done, which is a bit simpler, where they can see that nonlinearity, and they've used it. And to give you an idea of how good these things are, here's a map of the control knot. So the control knot is a 4x4 matrix. Little sticks correspond to the non-zero element of that matrix. Okay. So to have a control knot, you need to have here we have the triangle of 0, 0, 1, 1, and off-diagonal terms at the bottom, 1. So that is the control knot gate. So that corresponds to this thing, this little block here. So if the experiments would work perfectly, the theory, this is what you should get. And you can see the experiments here. Oh, there's small pieces that come in here, if you look at this thing. So they can show that they have some form of control knot, but not 100% precise. But that's OK. Experiments are hard, but they are a thing. The last piece I want to show on the detail of the experiments is these experiments with linear optics were initially done on optic tables with beam splitters and phase shifters. And this is very hard to keep things stable. And there's a push to look at what is called silicon waveguides. So very similar to these little chips that I showed you, except it's made of silicon. And then they put little waveguides in them. They make little tracks in the silicon. Photon goes through. So in some sense, some hole in optic fiber is some form of this. And then you can make gates by bringing two of these paths, these waveguides next to each other. They behave like beam splitters. And then they can put little heating pieces under there, which change the phase, which are phase shifters. And with this, you can go and build small chips that do small quantum computation for a few qubits. Well, I cannot remember how many they did, but it's about the order of five, six, seven of them, and you can show that hopefully they can scale. Again, long term to get a quantum computation. But this demonstrates that for small devices, we can kind of build devices so and that work the right way. So here's my final slide. Plot of two things. So when we try to assess how good are we in experiments at doing quantum computing, people, you need some kind of metric to compare different things. And most of the time, people kind of look at the number of qubits. And so here's this plot. I think I have a good. This is the number of qubits as a function of time. And it might be hard to see what these things are. The different colors correspond to different implementation. And I think I have little square or little stars, depending on do you have full unitary control on your system or just partial control. And the point I want to put in here is, so this is 1990, 1995, 2015, 2020. Good thing it's going up. But not incredibly fast, about 14 qubits with ion traps, about 12, 13 with an NMR. I don't have the maybe superconducting qubits. They have 9 qubits that they can manipulate and do certain things. So we can manipulate about a dozen of quantum bits. Hilbert space, 2 to the 12, it's about 5,000. I can tell you, 5,000 seems to be small when you kind of are a theoretician just modeling things. In the lab, when you lose your quantum state in a space which is 5,000 dimensional, then it's hard. In fact, we have an experiment right now with 12 qubits, and it works incredibly well up to 7. And because of the geometry, to go from 7 to 12, we cannot do one by one, but you have to jump. It works incredibly well up to 7, and when we bring the extra 5 qubits, we just lose the signal. And we've been looking for the last year to try to find that piece of signal and get it. So that gives you an idea of progress in the field. And I should point out that there's about 5 groups around the world who are planning to get 100 qubits in about 5 years. So there's a group on superconducting qubits. IBM, Google have a superconducting group. And so they claim they will reach 100 qubits in 5 years. Atomic Physics with Safman in Wisconsin claim he will get 100 qubits. Here in Waterloo, we have a group which works with the Google group on superconducting qubits. We have also a mix of electron and nuclear spins of David Corey, who aims to get 100 qubits, and ion traps. There's a group to do simulations of quantum physics with 100 qubits, both at Maryland and in Bloomington, Indiana. And I'm sure Oxford also claim they will get to 100 qubits within about 5 years. So that gives you some perspective of the slow things here. Suddenly, if indeed we're in 2020 or 2022, we get 100 qubits, then I think my stick is not high enough. So I'll have to do a log plot to this. So will we have 100 qubits? It seemed reasonable to me. How good control that we have on those? Not totally sure. But in the last, I would say, the number of qubits does not reflect really the amount of progress we've done experimentally in the last 10 years. And if I would characterize the progress, it's not with the number of qubits, but the amount of control that we have, and in particular, the number of error per gate. So a dozen years ago, you would publish in Science and Nature a small quantum information experiment with error rate, which would be about 5% error per gate. So if you do 3 gates, it's 15%. If you do 10 gates, it's 50%. Okay, so it would go. But people would kind of just do a few gates at quantum teleportation, where there's not too many gates. In the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years, people are really pushed up by understanding their system much better, developing a bunch of different techniques. So I briefly mentioned one of how we make pulse more robust. Okay, this is one of the many tricks we've learned. And then people reach error rate now, which are 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, even 10 to the minus 5. So one error per 100,000 gates. And that, with that level of control, then we can start to increase the number of qubits and not get lost in the Hilbert space. Okay, so this will finish the experimental side, and tomorrow we'll talk about complexity. Yeah?
I have one question. So could you also comment on the coherence? How do you deal with the coherence coming into this?
So I'm going to postpone that question when we talk about error correction.
Okay.
So there's two pieces. One of them, we try to mitigate the effect of the coherence, make much better system. And we are starting to do things so with error correction so that we will be able to leave it. Any other questions? Then time for lunch.